Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 7, canto 1, text 1 through 6. I'll quickly chant the Sanskrit, then we'll read the translation in unison for each verse. Sanaka uvacha nirgate narade sutta bhagavan badarayana shrutavam sthadhapri bretam tata kim akarod vibhu. Translation in unison. Rishi Sonaka asked, O Sutta, the great and transcendentally powerful Vyasadeva heard everything from Sri Narada Muni. So after Narada's departure, what did Vyasadeva do? Sutta huvacha brahma nadyam saraswatam ashrama pachimetate samya prashahiti proktam rishinam satravardana. Translation. Sri Sutta said, on the western bank of the river Saraswati, which is intimately related with the Vedas, there is a cottage for meditation at some point. Activities of the Sages. Text 3. Tasmin sva ashrame vyaso baddari sandamandate asino pa uparprishya prani dadyo mana svayam. Translation. In that place, Srila Vyasadeva, in his own ashram, which was surrounded by berry trees, sat down to meditate after touching water for purification. Bhakti yogena manasi samyak pranite amale apashat purusham purnam mayam chadhad aparasham. Translation. Thus he fixed his mind, perfectly engaged it by linking it in devotional service, bhakti yoga, without any tinge of materialism. And thus he saw the absolute personality of Godhead along with his external energy, which was under full control. Text 5. Yasya sammohito jiva atmanam tri gunamakam parapi manyate nartam tat kritam chapi padyati. Translation. Due to this external energy, the living entity, although transcendental to the three modes of material nature, thinks of himself as a material product and thus undergoes the reactions of material miseries.
Anartopasanam sakshad bhakti yogam adhuksaje lokasya jannato vidvams chakrishatvatta samhitam.
Translation. The material miseries of the living entity, which is superfluous to him, can be directly mitigated by the linking process of devotional service. But the mass of people do not know this, and therefore the learned Vyasadeva compiled this Vedic literature, which is in relation to the Supreme Truth.
Om Jnana Timirandasya Jananjana Shilakaya Chaksu Unmilitam Yenatasmai Sri Guruve Namaha Mukam Karoti Vachanam Pandumnam Jayati Girim Yakripa Tamaham Bande Sri Gurum Dimitarino Jayasi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nitananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasiri Gaur Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Avanchakal Paturubhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bahe Vacha Patitanam Pavane Vyo Vaishnavi Vyo Namo Namaha.
This chapter begins the culmination of this first canto, first volume of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This very, very significant section of the Bhagavatam, not only for the fact that it is the beginning, and of course any author sets the premise for their entire work in the beginning of the work, but also because this is the volume that Srila Prabhupada brought to America when he came. So much importance he felt was there in these first three volumes of the first canto of the Bhagavatam. This was his beginning translation work.
As he said many times in the beginning, I have put everything into these three volumes. From a very practical point of view, we know the Srila Prabhupada was quite elderly when he came, and he understood that he did not have much time. He didn't know directly how much time he would have. So, and as I say in his words, he said, I put everything into these three volumes. If you only know these three volumes, you can go back to Godhead. So, it's quite a daunting task that Kalakanta has strapped us speakers with to speak several verses at one time. Especially in this particular volume, this is one of my favorite volumes, this and the next one, The Prayers to Queen Kunti, one of the most glorious sections of the Srimad Bhagavatam. But, having said that, the topic or focal point of these verses that I've been given for today is oneness and difference. And usually this issue of oneness and difference is spoken of in regards to the Jivatma and the Paramatma, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the similarities between them. I'm sure all of you are familiar with the analogy. The example Prabhupada has used numerous times, and every speaker following in his line has, of the drop of water from the ocean and the entire ocean itself. That the similarity there, but the vast difference qualitatively and quantitatively. So a more advanced speaker, a more advanced devotee in the philosophy would take this point and expand on it. I'd like to look at this idea of oneness and difference from an entirely different perspective as it applies to the principle of executing devotional service. The process of devotional service is something that's given to us through the 12 Mahajans. And we have these 12 great personalities that are there to teach us. So one by one, those of you that are able, you could raise your hand. Let's go through the list, see if we can name all the Mahajans. Anyone want to jump in?
Lord Shiva.
Lord Shiva. Sukadev. Narada. Yamaraj, Prahlad, the four Kumaras, Bali Maharaj, come on, Shanaka, oh Janaka, yes, Janaka, Bhishma Dev, who have we missed? Kapila. Speaker of the Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami, and Swayambhu Manu. So these 12 personalities. Now there's an interesting thing. Prabhupada explained this in one lecture, and I found it interesting that he made this point. If we examine this, Shiva, Swayambhu Narada, Swayambhu Manu, Prahlad, Janaka, Bali, Yamaraj, and Lord Brahma. These seven, they're all grihasthas. Narada, the four Kumaras, Kapila, Bhishma Dev, and Sukadev. These five are brahmacharis. So we see that there is a selection of each ashram, that both ashrams are there, and that predominantly we find that the householders are present amongst the Mahajans. Now, there's a very significant point here, because generally speaking, when we in the traditional sense think of a greatly advanced renounced devotee of high spiritual caliber, we tend to think of a sannyasi. This is the usual tradition. But here we see amongst the 12 Mahajans, the majority of these Mahajans are from the household ashram. They're from an ashram that is not so generally acquainted with the principles of knowledge, detachment, renunciation, advancement in devotional service, like that. But here we see that they've given us this very nice example. And why is it that they've given this example? I mean, why are they able to give this example, I should say? Because, as it's explained very clearly here in the second of these verses that we read, Srila Prabhupada, I'll read this purport to this verse because it's very significant. For spiritual advancement of knowledge, a suitable place
and an atmosphere are definitely required. The place on the western bank, when I read that sentence, it immediately reminded me when Srila Prabhupada began his preaching in 1968 in San Francisco. Mukunda and Shamsundar, they had contacts through the San Francisco community at that time, and the community in San Francisco at that time was predominantly the hippie movement, and they were connected with many of the different musicians at that time, the Grateful Dead and the like. And so they arranged this big concert we're all very familiar with if you've read these biographies at Family Dog Auditorium. Huge big scene, so many bands on stage, so much rock music, and then Srila Prabhupada came. And the audience and the performers were all very respectful to Srila Prabhupada. Anyway, at the end of the evening, after all was said and done, Prabhupada turned and said, "This is no place for a brahmachari." So the point being that spiritual life executed in that atmosphere is very difficult. They did it under Prabhupada's direction, though. So, for spiritual advancement of knowledge, a suitable place and atmosphere are definitely required. The place on the western bank of the Saraswati is especially suitable for this purpose. And there is the ashram of Vyasadeva at Samyaprasha. Srila Vyasadeva was a householder, yet his residence is called an ashram. An ashram is a place where spiritual culture is always foremost. It does not matter whether the place belongs to a householder or to a mendicant. The whole Varnashram system is so designed that each and every status of life is called an ashram. This means that spiritual culture is the common factor for all. The brahmacharis, the grihastas, the vanaprastras, and the sannyasis all belong to the same mission of life, namely, realization of the Supreme. Therefore, none of them are less important as far as spiritual culture is concerned. The difference is a matter of formality on the strength of renunciation. The sannyasis are held in high estimation on the strength of practical renunciation. So, this is a very clear point that Prabhupada makes here. They were the 12 Mahajans we were discussing, or as Prabhupada's pointing out here, anyone in the household ashram, not in the household residence necessarily, but in the household ashram, is qualified spiritually, is capable of instructing spiritual science because of the ashramic, if you use that phrase, lifestyle they're leading. The home, the residence, everything about it becomes spiritual. Now, in the grihastha ashram, as Prabhupada mentions the different ashrams here, the tendency is there for sense gratifications. As Prabhupada practically said, it is a license for sense gratification. The association with the opposite sex, the comforts of the home. This is why, as we're just winding up the Chaturmasya period, the mendicants, they are known for traveling. Sannyasis would generally travel, stay 3 days, 5 days, one place, go on like that. But during the rainy season, which is just finishing in India, it's very difficult to travel, so they would stay in one place. But staying in one place for a long period of time means you get a little comfortable. You know, you put your picture up on the wall, you get your favorite blanket, your shoes go over there in that corner, you get your prasadam at a certain time. All of these things become a very comfortable, easy lifestyle. So that's just natural. It's not like, you know, any... It's just the way things go. So to prevent that, the sannyasis would perform... practical renunciation. They would perform extra austerities at the time they weren't traveling like this so that they wouldn't develop this mood of comfort and... relaxed attitude that's generally associated with the household life. So the way that that's the contrast to that is that one engages themselves in spiritual culture and makes their residence completely spiritually focused. This is why in the very first section of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada explains how it is essential. Actually, no, I take that back. It's in the second canto, first volume. Srila Prabhupada explains that it's essential for the householders to have deities in their home. Because this transforms the home from a residence of just some people to a residence of the Lord, and we become His servants. And then in that condition, it doesn't matter what particular ashram you're in. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Grihe Thakur, Bane Thakur, Sadahari Boli Thakur. Whether you're a sannyasi, whether you're a grihastha, you take up the chanting of the holy name. And when you have the Lord residing in your home, this is naturally what's going to happen. You're going to be reciting the Lord's name as you engage in serving Him. You're going to be engaged in the different activities of mantras and holding programs and inviting people over, and kirtan will go on like this. So in this way, there's the same principle. Both are executing devotional service, but there is a difference. Am I not close enough? Except, okay, that's probably my mistake. Sorry about that. So, just like here in this residence, this ashram, this temple, whoa. Is that actually what they want? Okay. We have some that have taken up the path of brahmachari, some that have actually taken vows to remain brahmachari, that are planning in that way, some that are taking up, that just recently have taken their vows of entering the grihastha ashram. I can probably say without much doubt that most of you sitting here will take up the grihastha ashram. It's not that many that actually take up the vow of renunciation. This is the nature of society. There's four ashrams, that's 100%. You divide that down, you got maybe 25% that is the renunciates. The brahmacharis have the choice. The grihasthas are committed, the vanaprasthas have given it up, and the sannyasis have made the vow. So you've got 25% that don't really do so. But there is, as I say, there's this difference in which the two ashrams means, but they have that oneness in their execution of single-minded devotional service. The phrase that Srila Prabhupada used when he would arrange for the marriages, this is back when he would do this, he said, redoubled strength, husband and wife together. Redoubled strength. Individually, we have a certain level of strength that we can execute whatever we can in devotional service. But the fact of the matter is that with a strong partner who is equally strong in devotional service, then it's redoubled strength, as Prabhupada said. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he sent some of his senior most sannyasis from Calcutta to London to do some preaching. And they were mildly successful. They got the darshan of the queen, got to come before her. You know, I don't think she chanted any mantra or anything. But Srila Prabhupada sent four grihastha couples to London, and within no time, they were all over the newspapers. They had the great impact with their Harinams. They had influenced some of the prominent people of the time period. So this can actually bring one to a very powerful state of executing devotional service. There was a time in the early years of our ISKCON society when we were all brahmacharis. Everyone was brahmachari and brahmacharini. When I joined the St. Louis Temple in 1973, we had 27 devotees in the temple. We had two grihastha couples. Everybody else was brahmacharis and brahmacharinis. Now, in ISKCON at that time, if you realized in a very noble way as opposed to an inglorious way, which sometimes also happened, that, you know, I should probably take up a different ashram, it was considered you had fallen down. So you just, what happened to Chandra? Oh, he fell down and got married. He's finished. We'll never see him again. He's gone. This was the general attitude. It was an unfortunate attitude and a very inappropriate attitude, because I can't think of any one of those guys in that age that are still brahmacharis. So it's just the course of nature. So if there's a realistic point of view from one's beginning, fortunately the temple I was in was not so much of that mindset. The temple president was very, very nice devotee. He was a long-time grihastha. And, well, at that time, if you were 27 years old, you were an old man. And if you'd been married 4 years, my God, you've been married forever. So, but he was a very sensible individual, and he raised all of us as his children, like a very practical family. So there was no
shunning of people when they changed ashrams or something like that. So, you know, these types of mentalities don't foster this understanding of the oneness in executing devotional service. There's a difference according to the ashram, but there's a oneness in the principle of staying focused in purifying one's life, of dedicating oneself to the service of the spiritual master, and in spreading the mission of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This Prabhupada, well, verse 4, first word, I'm sorry, a little ahead of myself here. The middle of this purport, I love this sentence Prabhupada uses. This means that spiritual culture is the common factor in all ashrams. So, in order to have an ashram, it means that spiritual consciousness must be the common factor. This means that we're engaged in devotional service, that we're striving for that level of purification. So, we shouldn't place too much importance on the external differences that we see. They are practical in the way society is executed. They are practical in the duties of the different members of society. The householders are expected to support the other three ashrams. So those of you that are thinking to get married, figure out how to get rich, because you're going to have to support 75% of the society. This is the way it goes. The householders, they are responsible for supporting the vanaprastras, the brahmacharis, and the sannyasis. Sannyasis don't work. Vanaprastras are renounced and just traveling and going to, and brahmacharis work only for the guru. They're not out turning, you know, a paycheck at the local Walmart or whatever. You know, so the grihasthas have a great responsibility. But in the differences of the ashrams and their practical applications, the similarities is their dedication to the process of devotional service. Now, when one engages in devotional service, it's expected that the vision will become purified. Premanjana Charita Bhakti Vilochanena. This is that famous verse from Brahma Samhita, that when one's eyes are tinged with the salve of love, then one sees things completely different. Now, on to the point I was making about text number 4, Prabhupada starts this purport off with a very nice, perfect vision of the absolute truth is possible only by the linking process of devotional service. So, if we want to live a life that is an ashram, if we want to lead a life of purification, that means we have to be engaged in devotional service. And that devotional service is the very means by which we can purify our vision in order to perfectly see the absolute truth, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We have no ability in our current state. I always told my children this growing up. Between ourselves and the personality of Godhead, there's Maya. That's her duty. That's her job. She has a responsibility to keep all those who are not qualified. We have no ability to overcome Maya on our own. You just can't do it. She's too powerful. She's a pure devotee. She's got a very focused job, and she's very good at it. She's been doing it for, you know, ever. So we have no ability to overcome that on our own. But when we take shelter of the spiritual energy, and in our case, taking shelter of the spiritual energy means the process of devotional service, then Maya steps aside. Actually, she bows her head at the feet of that person who is committed to the process of devotional service. Oh, yes, now you go. Then, when she steps aside, we can perfectly see the personality of Godhead. We can perfectly see the path that's lined out, charted out for us in advancing in devotional service. This is the importance of the spiritual energy. This is the importance of taking that shelter to be able to see things clearly. What's that verse from Ishapanasa? Understanding the world of omniscience and science side by side. Side by side means you have to be able to distinguish between which is which. That ability to distinguish between which is which comes from the guidance of the Mahajans, who are instructing not according to what ashram they're in. This isn't the person doesn't sit down and say, okay, I'm a householder, so today I'll talk to you about such and such. I'm a sannyasi, so today we'll talk about... No, the principle of devotional service is the same. regardless of one's ashram. So the instructions that one receives, the process of hearing those instructions is there to give us that goal of pure devotional service. So this is where the point of oneness and difference comes in, is that the person's instructing, the process of being instructed, and the activity of executing, all of them are on the same regardless of one's external temporary identity. Do we have to identify ourselves as a sannyasi or grihastha? Certainly. There's different responsibilities. Sannyasis don't mix with the women. They don't take up activities of business within society. Grihasthas are required to take up business activities. They have a more comfortable relationship with children, families, things like this. So in this way, there is some external point, but we have to keep in mind the focal goal. Now, I wanted to mention another aspect of this, and today is the disappearance day of Kashishwar Pandit. It's also the disappearance day of Bhugarbha Goswami. And both of these devotees have very significant points in their life that celebrate this oneness and difference. Bhugarbha Goswami was a very intimate and dear friend of Lokanath Goswami. Lokanath Goswami, of course, the guru of Narottam Das Thakur. Lokanath Goswami was residing in Navadvip about the time of Mahaprabhu's Leela there. And when Mahaprabhu took the sannyas vows, Lokanath Goswami wanted to go with him to Puri when he was relocating to Jagannath Puri. Instead, Mahaprabhu wanted him to go to Vrindavan. Instructed him that he should go to Vrindavan and reside there. He had a purpose for him there. Matter of fact, he told him in the future, you will actually initiate a young boy by the name of Narottam. So both Lokanath and then, of course, in Narottam's history, which is a whole other story, he had a dream about this too. So this was foretold long before it happened. Lokanath Goswami didn't really want to go by himself. So Bhugarbha Goswami, well, neither of them were Goswami at the time, but Bhugarbha, who was a associate of Lokanath, living also there in Navadvip at the time of Mahaprabhu's pastimes, said, I'll go with him. I don't have any, you know, I'm not married. I don't have any particular engagement here, nothing that's holding me back. I'll go with him. We're good friends. And so Mahaprabhu said, yes, the two of you go. These were the first two of the prominent Goswamis to go to Vrindavan, long before the six Goswamis that we know. Long before Rupa and Sanatan, Gopal Bhatta, long before any of them went there, Bhugarbha and Lokanath Goswami resided. Bhugarbha and Lokanath Goswami resided all the different places. They would actually go to the different holy places, and the holy places would call out to them, the personification of the Jamuna, or the personification of Chiragat, or the personification of Sankori, Chora, these different places, they would call out to them and say, oh, this is where this pastime took place. Because they had the instruction from Mahaprabhu to begin the process of re-identifying all of the holy places in Vrindavan. So in this way, they traveled everywhere together. They slept together. They ate together. They studied together. They chanted japa together. They were inseparable. And it actually mentions that Bhugarbha and Lokanath were like one body. One mind in two separate bodies. So here we have this oneness and difference. They were completely one in their thought, in their goal, in their seva, and in their dedication to the instructions of Mahaprabhu, but of course two different individuals. So in this way, they were setting up the foundation for which the other Goswamis would come and then expand the entire process of re-developing Vrindavan to the level that we now know all the different holy places of Krishna's pastimes. Of course, maybe it's developed a little further than some of us would like right now, but at any rate, we at least have the ability to go anywhere in Braj Mandala and see all the different pastime places that took place there. And these are to this day known, and this is because of the early work of these two devotees, Bhugarbha and Lokanath Goswami. Now, there was another devotee, Kashishwar Pandit. Kashishwar Pandit, let me just... Kashishwar Pandit was also residing in, actually he was in Puri with Maharaj, with Mahaprabhu. Once Mahaprabhu went to Puri, he was residing there. And it was come to be known that Rupa Goswami had established the Govindaji deity. Of course, back then, as we know, the process of getting messages back and forth was you would write a letter, give it to a carrier, and he would take a four-month journey to go to Jagannath Puri, between Jagannath Puri and Vrindavan. And then 4 months later, Mahaprabhu would get a letter from Gopal Bhatta Goswami, Narottam has arrived, this, that, the other, like that. So in this way, after Govindaji was established by Rupa Goswami, information was sent to Mahaprabhu that the Govinda deity is here, and everyone is worshiping very nice, he's so beautiful. So Mahaprabhu wanted to send someone to assist Rupa Goswami in the worship, because he knew he had instructed Rupa Goswami. He had so many books to write, and we know Rupa Goswami wrote prolifically so many literatures, and uncovering and establishing the holy places like that. So for him to have to spend so much time worshiping the deity, this wasn't practical. So let me see, who should I go? Kashishwar Yuko. Kashishwar Pandit was, of course, very submissive and humble to the service of Mahaprabhu. He said, I don't really want to. He said, Mahaprabhu, he said, I'm so attached to serving your lotus feet. He said, I just, the idea of being separated from you, traveling all the way to Vrindavan and residing in Vrindavan while you're here in Puri and knowing that I won't see you on a daily basis, but I'm your surrendered soul. I don't want to disobey you. You are the Prabhu. You please give me a way I can do both. So Mahaprabhu thought. He gave Kashishwar a deity. This deity was this deity was an exact duplicate of Mahaprabhu's appearance. But it was understood to be Krishna. This deity is called Gaur Gopal. And he took this deity with him, and the deity was placed to the side of Govindaji. And then, of course, this was the way that Kashishwar Pandit was able to, in oneness, not be separated from the Lord, but still there would be some difference. And it was the way that Mahaprabhu showed the oneness of himself with Krishna, but allowed Kashishwar to worship him in this way. A little difference there. So that deity to this day, when the time in history came and the Muslims attacked and all the different deities were protected, some were buried in the ground by the pujaris, they didn't have much time to do anything, some were put into the bottom of kunds, some were sent off to neighboring villages just outside of Braj, and some were sent to the kings of Jaipur, because the kings of Jaipur were very, very powerful. Are we in the way here? No? The kings of Jaipur were very, very powerful, and they were able to protect the deities very nicely. Got it? Okay. All right. So in this way, the Govindaji deity went to Jaipur. And if you go to... How many of you have been to Jaipur? Yeah? Only a few. Something you should hanker for. Something you should hanker for, to go to Jaipur and sit in the darshan of Govindaji. So amazing. Mangal Aarti there, I'll give a safe estimate, 3,000 to 4,000 people. Yeah, probably more than that, but that's a safe estimate. And if you have ever had a hankering to fulfill your latent desire to be in a mosh pit, go to the Govindaji temple for Mangal Aarti. It's an amazing experience, all these devotees there, and they're all completely focused on Govindaji, and they're all chanting at the same time. It's incredible. And then what happens is it's time for circumambulation. You better be moving. You better be moving, or you're going to be moved. It's just incredible. Anyway, when you look at the Govindaji deity, there to the side, to Govindaji's left side, to the right side when you're looking, is the Gaur Gopal. Very, very beautiful. So, in this way, both of these personalities that are honored today had these similarities of what we're trying to talk about on this this particular verse here. And that's all I got. So I wasn't sure the length of the class, and I didn't want to overextend my stay, thus not get invited back again. So we'll finish there. If anyone has any questions or comments, right in the door with a question. Yes. Good to do. It doesn't always work that way. Sometimes one, you know, just due to circumstances or, you know, a natural progression of the parents' arrangement or whatever the case may be, one may come to devotional service already with a spouse. So these situations may be a little different, but if one can perform that, my wife and I have discussed this many times that those devotees that did have some time within an ashram temple lifestyle, you know, seem to fare, not always, but seem to fare a little better because they've got a foundation on which to base their grihastha ashram. Otherwise, you take shelter of an older grihastha couple that can give you guidance and direction in that way. It's always nice to perform austerities, whether those are austerities of practicing Brahma. And of course, even within, this is the point Prabhupada made, that even the grihasthas can be referred to as sannyasis, he said, because of their vow of celibacy except for purpose of having children. So, you know, either way, you're going to end up, you know, reducing the activities that are generally associated with the household ashram of a grihamedi. So, yeah. And if you're not able to, then you just take guidance in how to settle things nicely from those around you. That's the importance of communities. And communities doesn't just mean a whole bunch of people your own age. Communities means all different ages. That's how we learn, you know, elders, younger, you know, how to help with the children, how to learn from the seniors. Just like in our community here, having Mother Indrani, you know, it's such a blessing having Mother Indrani. I don't know how, everybody knows Mother Indrani, right? Such a blessing having her, you know. She's like everybody's grandmother. She has no qualms about pointing things out. That's what grandmothers do, you know. So situations like that. And then we have so many married couples in this community. They've been married 30, 35 years, 40, you know, that's got some potency to it, you know. Those are people that have been around and can give some practical instruction. Yeah, so like that. Anyone else? Questions, comments? Yes. That's Prabhupada's instructions, yeah. Yeah, that's clearly Prabhupada's instructions. It's a challenge to live up to it, but that is the guideline that Prabhupada has set for us, and that's the standard which we should hope for. Yes, Prabhu.
Many times you read in Prabhupada's books that Prabhupada, he says that sannyasa is mandatory at a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean everybody, or does that just mean some people?
Mm-hmm. Bhaktivinoda Thakur instituted what he called Kshetra Sannyas. My wife is very keen on pointing this out. It's been one of her things for a long time. Kshetra Sannyas means that you live in the same residence, the same place, but you separate to some degree, a bit like Vanaprastha. It doesn't require the formal acceptance of the sannyas ashram and traveling and all like that. This is a practical point. The real issue is that we should strive for renunciation in the end of our lives. If at the age of, well, no, I can't say 60 because I'm 60. Okay. If at the age of 80, I love that poster. It's a guy in his 70s in a wetsuit with a surfboard and it says, old age will always be 15 years older than I am. That's my mantra. At any rate, if in our elder years we're still living the comfortable, you know, legitimate life of sense gratification of the household ashram that we lived in our 30s, we've done something wrong. You know, we should gradually be working towards renunciation so that by the time we are old, that there is a natural separation, a natural renunciation. Whether it includes an actual putting on a saffron and taking a danda or not, not everybody's equipped for that.
So, you know, some of us will just peacefully pass away, you know, in our household ashram, surrounded by our devotee friends with our deities on our chest, and hopefully get to take next birth in the womb of one of you nice young kids and become a Gurukuli.
Just wanted to make a comment. My Guru Maharaj, Mahavishnu Maharaj, said at one point in time in class, that even the animals understand this fact, that as you come close towards the end of your life, you need to be renounced. You know, he said, you'll never see an animal living in the family of his, you know, whatever his family is. Yeah, either it goes away or, you know, somehow or other dies alone or passes away alone. Now, that may be a nature's way of making sure that, you know, they understand the renunciation. As human beings, as he said, you know, we have to make sure that we follow the same process and understand that when it comes the time to leave this body, you know, this whole world is basically like a train station, he said, you know. Train stop in India, everybody's sitting around, but as soon as your train comes, you jump up and get in the train and you're off to your destination. You leave the people who are there. So.
Chanaka Pandit is very expert at pointing out things that we can learn from others, particularly animals. There's a whole section of his maxims that the five things we can learn from the dog, six things we can learn from the rooster, like that. I live in the woods, I don't live in the woods, but my house is on 11 acres of land, and there's a lot of feral cats around where we are, and we've kind of more or less adopted one that we put some prashadam out and stuff for. Anyway, this one, it's been around our house for about 10 years or so, I guess. And when it first started around, as feral cats do, it got pregnant, it had four or five kittens, and, you know, and now over the years, it's quite old. I don't know how old, because I, you know, just showed up, but quite old, and I've noticed very detached, you know, like you're saying, you know, just not, you know, doesn't mix with the other cats. They come around, want to start their cat stuff, it just walks away. It's not interested, you know, and, you know, just finds a quiet place, you know, like that, just something simple. So there are things like that we can learn from the animals. Chanaka Pandit's writings are very instructive in this way. You know, they're very, very nice. Prabhupada quoted them on many occasions, you know. So we should, this is the process of learning, is to learn how we're different from the animals, learn what we can actually learn from them in the same time. Call a controversial.
I thought it was very appropriate to talk about oneness and difference and the Grihastha ashram in the same class. Because it's the most immediate experience of oneness and difference most of us have. You become part of a couple, but you also remain an individual. And like the old maxim goes, the wife is thinking, I can change this guy. And the husband is thinking, oh, my wife will never change. And both are surprised.
Both get the shock of their life, yes, yes.
So you remain an individual, but you become part of a team. So it's opposed to be a way to increase your service.
All right. Redoubled strength. Yeah. Anyone else? Nothing else? We'll finish there. Srimad Bhagavatam ki Srila Prabhupada ki Bodhi Premanandi.